WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Ruth Reichel was restaurant critic for the New York Times, she wanted to dine out incognito, so she used an alias and often wore a wig and phony glasses. But she's opening her life to readers in her memoirs. Reichel, who is now editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine, has written the second volume of her memoirs. It's called Comfort Me with Apples, and it's about her adventures with food, friendship, and love. It's a follow-up to her first memoir, the bestseller Tender at the Bone, Growing Up at the Table. I spoke with her in 1998, after Tender at the Bone was published, shortly before she left the Times. You might think Ruth Reichel's love of food dates back to her mother's wonderful home cooking. But you'd be wrong. Her mother was not only a terrible cook, she was what Reichel describes as taste blind. Her mother couldn't tell if food was spoiled, would sometimes serve it that way after it had turned, and have no idea why her family found it nauseating. I asked Reichel how she became a food professional, coming from this taste blind background.
Well, you know, I mean, I really felt that I was sort of shaped by my mother's handicap. You know, I mean, it's the way the children of deaf people are probably more aware of sound. I became very aware of taste because I was so fascinated by the fact that my mother couldn't taste these things. And then in self-defense, I started cooking. And my mother really would make these dreadful concoctions. I mean, she really prided herself on something called everything stew, where she would take everything in the refrigerator, all the leftovers, and put them all together. And one day I was watching her put in leftover turkey and broccoli and a little, you know, can of mushroom soup. And she's throwing things in, and half an apple pie goes in. And she says, you know, I sort of look at her and say, Mom. And she says, oh, it'll be fine. And then she starts throwing everything in. And you know, in defense, I started cooking because I didn't want to eat that.
Now, I know your first experiences in the food world as a professional was working in restaurants. One of the restaurants you worked in was L'Escargot. Would you describe the restaurant?
Well, this was in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I was going to school at the University of Michigan, and it was a very, very fancy French restaurant for the mid-60s, and certainly for Ann Arbor, Michigan, and certainly for a college town. And it was somebody's dream. I mean, I had the great privilege, really, of participating in this mad, passionate dream of the owner who did everything beautifully, which you can't do in a restaurant. I mean, he bought Baccarat crystal, which is insane. I mean, it all breaks in the first month, and Limoges china and wonderful chandeliers. And he brought a chef from the Four Seasons in New York, and he got the best grill man as a sous chef, and wonderful, wonderful waiters and waitresses, real professionals. I mean, the kind of people that you don't see very much anymore, who were very proud of their profession and very good at it. And I've always thought that a really good restaurant, when it runs well, is like being on a movie set. You become a family. It becomes a whole life of its own. And this restaurant was like that. We became very tight. And as we watched this restaurant go down.
Go down?
Well, I mean, it was a dream. Ann Arbor was not a place that could support that kind of a restaurant in those days. I mean, it was very high-end French food at very high-end prices. And people would come once for the curiosity but never come again. And as business really faded, we all pulled together. We really rooted for, I mean, what happened was the first chef was a real thief. And I learned a lot about how, you know, most restaurants go under because of employee theft, or many of them do. And this guy was a real pro. I mean, he would take whole sides of meat, wrap them in aluminum foil, bury them in the garbage, and then go out after the garbage had been taken out. He would come back in the middle of the night and take these pieces of meat and sell them. Wow. And we all really started rooting for the owner. I mean, nobody wanted to see this going on. And it was no good. I mean, ultimately, it closed.
There was a waiter at this restaurant who kind of initiated you in the ways of restaurants, and he told you that the restaurant was a war zone. What did he mean by that?
Well, it's a common thing that waiters say. I mean, what he said was that the kitchen was at war with the customers, and we were the go-betweens, and that our job was to make sure that the customers never knew that the kitchen was at war with them. And this entailed a lot of subterfuge. For instance, if a customer wanted to send a steak back because it was cooked too much, he said, now you can go back and you can tell the chef that the customer says it's overcooked. And he's going to scream and yell because he's at war with the customer. On the other hand, if you go back and you're very humble and you say, I made a terrible mistake. He said that he wanted it rare, but I wrote down well done. He'll scream at you, but he'll give you a new steak because he's not at war with you.
Yeah, but he might be at war with you if that happens too much.
Well, it doesn't happen that often, but it was just a matter of us sort of always taking the blame so that we would get big tips. He also, you know, really felt that it was our responsibility to come up with a good story for the customers. He said, you know, they should go home with more than a good meal. You have to provide an experience for them that is, you know, that they can talk about. So he encouraged me to pretend that I was a foreign student who was here and had not had enough money and that I needed to work to support myself. And I developed a great story. I mean, my customers would be crying and giving me big tips at the end of it. But he said that this was a good thing because I was really giving them value for their money.
Now, at the New York Times, you're kind of famous for using disguises when you're reviewing a restaurant so that you can't be spotted. So you can eat anonymously. What do you use, wigs?
Not only wigs. I keep buying new wigs. I've now got 11. And I do use those. I also have a lot of glasses. I have fake fingernails. I have whole outfits in different sizes. I mean, I'll sometimes put on like three pairs of pants, one over the other, or, you know, three skirts so I look much larger than I am. I've learned about, I'm not normally a makeup person, but I've learned about makeup, and you can really do amazing things with, you can change the shape of your lips and, you know, change the color of your eyebrows, and I do all that stuff.
Do you pay cash or use for fake credit cards?
I use fake credit cards.
Does the Times help you get them?
No, I have figured out my own strategies for getting them. They don't want to know about how I do this. I also often ask the people I'm with to pay, and then I just write them a check.
Right.
But if you start pulling out wads of cash, it's a little, you know, it's a giveaway. I mean, go out to a really expensive restaurant and pull out $500 in cash. Who carries that kind of money around?
Something you did that was pretty controversial, I think, I don't remember when this was exactly, but you took a star away from the restaurant Le Cirque, which I guess had been, what, 4 stars, and you demoted it to 3. Do I have that right?
Yes, you have it right.
I don't
and
even know
right
how the star...
right after I came.
It was right after you came?
Yeah.
I don't even know how the star rating works and who determines what makes a restaurant 4 or 3 stars or whatever, so why don't we start with an explanation of that?
Well, the star system is very much up to whoever the critic is at the time. And 4 stars is the most that you can get. And it's a very exalted, there are only 6 4-star restaurants at the moment. And it's a very big deal for restaurants.
So when you say 4-star restaurant, this is like a New York Times 4-star restaurant?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And it has a lot of weight to the restaurants. When they get a 4-star rating, it's a very big deal for them, and it brings them lots and lots and lots of business. To demote a restaurant from 3 stars to 2 stars is not such a big deal, but to demote it from 4 stars to 3 stars is, it's huge. This was right after I had arrived in New York 5 years ago. I had not had a star rating system at the LA Times where I'd been for 10 years. I wasn't that impressed with the star system at the time. I mean, I've since come to see how, if nothing else, how economically powerful it is for the restaurants. But I started going to Le Cirque, and they didn't know me, and I was not treated well. And everybody had always, you know, jumped up and down about what a great restaurant it was. And, you know, I had some really terrible experiences there. You know, I went once with another woman, and we were made to wait 45 minutes at the bar for, you know, a supposedly non-smoking table, and we were still stuck in the smoking section. And when I asked for a wine list, a maitre d' came over and snatched it out of my hands after a minute and said, "I need that list," and he took it off to some man nearby, and I couldn't get it back. And and then I thought, well, I wonder, after I'd been there a few times, I thought, well, I wonder what will happen if, not if I make a reservation in my own name, but just if I go in undisguised. By then I knew he knew who I was. And sure enough, I go, and I have made the only reservation I could get was like 9:45. But I said, I think I'll go at 9 o'clock and just see what happens. And we get to the door, and there's a huge crowd waiting for tables. And the owner comes, he parts this crowd, and it's like the Red Sea parting. And he comes through to me, and he pulls me forward and says, "The King of Spain is waiting in the bar, but your table is ready," and leads me to a table. And I thought, you know, this is too wonderful. I've just got to write about, you know, what happened to me as just me, an ordinary person, and then what happened to me as the restaurant critic of the New York Times, and write about the two experiences.
Now, I could see a restaurant easily explaining this by saying, well, of course we treat our regulars with special care. That's why people become regulars, because they know they're treated as like part of the family. We know what they like to eat. We know what their preferences are. We know whether they smoke or not. And it's lovely, like at a neighborhood restaurant, when you come in all the time, they say hello, they bring you the salad when you sit down, they know what you want. Everybody likes to be treated like a regular.
Absolutely, and regulars deserve to be treated. I mean, they've paid their dues, and they deserve to be treated better. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that ordinary people shouldn't be treated well.
Right.
And there's a real difference between, for instance, not every restaurant can have your table ready when you arrive. I mean, they can't always calculate how long people are going to stay at a table. An apology goes a long way. If they come up to you and say, "I'm so sorry that, can I give you a glass of wine? Can I somehow make this up to you?" You don't feel badly. You don't feel as if you've been dissed. On the other hand, if it's just, you know, "Oh, go wait over there, we'll let you know when your table is ready," it's a matter of attitude. And Le Cirque at that time was really known for not being particularly nice to ordinary people. I have to say that their attitude has changed dramatically.
Oh, have you changed their star rating?
I have. I mean, they reopened. They closed for a while, and they've reopened in a new location. And I went in many times, in many disguises, and they were wonderful. They were just wonderful. And I really felt that they had sort of seen that there was no point in not trying to be good to everyone.
My guest, Ruth Reichel, is editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine and former restaurant critic for the New York Times. She's just published her second food memoir. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Ruth Reichel. Her new food memoir is called Comfort Me with Apples. When we spoke in 1998, she was restaurant critic for the New York Times. Now, what's your approach to reviewing? How many times do you typically go to a restaurant? How do you order off the menu?
I go endlessly. I mean, I go until I really feel that I've eaten just about everything on the menu, that I've been there with a big group and a small group, on a weekend, on a weeknight, lunch and dinner. I've had every kind of, you know, combination that you can have. I mean, I'm very lucky. I work for an institution that is willing to put this kind of money into it. I would never go fewer than three times. I've gone as many as nine. And I really do try and, you know, get the entire range of experiences that you can have from a restaurant.
What kind of impact have you seen your reviews have, for better and worse, on restaurants?
Well, I felt very good about the Le Cirque thing. I mean, I really felt that that had had an impact, that taking that star away, which really stung. I mean, it's a wonderful restaurant. I mean, the food is terrific. But I think he really thought, you know, times are changing. I think I've seen that women are treated better. I don't think that's just up to me. But I think, you know, it's also changing times. Women are spending more money. They're more business women. The whole sort of cliche about women not tipping so well is not true anymore. But I've certainly seen that change in the last few years. You know, I don't tend to go back to restaurants much after I've been there. So it's not that I, you know, can see the impact. Mm-hmm. But I've certainly read, you know, restaurants saying, you know, they got 4 stars and, you know, they got 20,000 phone calls the next day.
I want to ask you a little bit about restaurant etiquette. What advice do you have about how much to tip? And when do you think it's appropriate, if ever, to penalize a waiter if the service isn't good or if the food is bad?
Well, if the food is bad, you can't penalize the waiter. That's absolutely not fair. It's not his fault.
Yes.
Now, remember when you're, you know, listening to this answer, that I am a former waitress for a very long time. I'm a very good tipper. You know, I think that you can make someone's day much, much brighter by tipping well, and another couple dollars isn't going to make that much difference to you. And it's certainly okay to penalize a waiter for things that you know are his fault. I would penalize a waiter for, you know, not being helpful, for things that he said, for demeanor. I would not penalize him for food appearing or not appearing on time.
When do you think it's okay to send back a dish?
It's always okay to send back a dish. You're there to be pleased. I mean, this is your night out. You're paying to get what you want. And, I mean, as a restaurant critic, I never send food back because I don't want to draw attention to myself. But as a civilian, I feel like I am in the restaurant to be pleased, and if it's not what I wanted, I send it back.
From your years as a waitress, what are some of the things that patrons at restaurants do that you know drive the staff crazy?
Oh, there are so many things that drive the staff crazy. You know, one of the biggest ones is people who want to change everything on the menu. You know, I want this, but I don't want this sauce, and I don't want this vegetable. And, you know, you've got to go back to the kitchen and say to the chef, you know, that woman out there, the chef is going to scream at you. It's really awful. The other thing is that people can be unbelievably rude to waiters and waitresses. There's a whole attitude of respect that you deserve as a waiter. And if you don't get it, it's very annoying. And a patron does that at his peril, I think.
Did you eat out a lot as a kid?
Yes. My parents were older when I was born. My dad was 50, my mother was 40. And they had a life. And they sort of expected me to fit into their life, and also because my mother was not the world's greatest cook, we fortunately went out a lot. And we lived in New York, and my mother, she used restaurants in a great way, even though she was taste blind. And she really wasn't interested in food. She was very interested in the theater of restaurants. So I grew up in the great days of restaurant associates when they were doing the Forum of the 12 Caesars and La Fonda del Sol and all these really exciting theatrical restaurants. And we didn't have a lot of money, so we wouldn't go eat in those restaurants, but we would go and have a drink and sit in the bar and look at the restaurant, and then we would go someplace cheap for dinner.
You know, in talking about how your mother liked the theater of restaurants, you like to write about the kind of subculture within the restaurant. For example, a recent review, you wrote, if you are over 30, weigh more than 105 pounds, favor bright colors, or bite your fingernails, Bond Street could do you damage. No matter how confident you may be in the real world, it's hard to face an entire universe of thin, young, beautiful people dressed in black without wondering what you are doing there. Do you enjoy writing about the subculture that a restaurant seems to attract?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think you need to know that. I mean, people say, well, how is the food? And that's only a piece of it. I mean, if you're walking into a restaurant, you want to know what the people are wearing, what they look like, how you're going to feel when you're there. And if you're walking into a really hip scene dressed like Grandma Moses, you're going to feel ridiculous. I love that whole side of restaurants, that whole ability you have to walk in and be somebody else for the time that you're there. You know, it's like meeting new people. You get to reinvent yourself. And that's one thing that restaurants do for us.
Well, Ruth Reichel, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Are you off to go to a restaurant now?
Yes, of course.
Well, enjoy.
Thank you.
Ruth Reichel recorded in 1998 when she was restaurant critic for the New York Times. She's now editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine. Her new memoir, Comfort Me with Apples, is a follow-up to her bestseller, Tender at the Bone. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.